Hello and welcome to Mohawks Meet the Team series, a podcast dedicated to the team behind creating the strategy title, Old World. We'll get to know more about the team and their work on the project. This week, we speak to Mustafa, the technical director at Mohawk Games, and we learn about his journey through video games and some of his martial arts skills, and much more, so stay tuned. Welcome to the show, Mustafa.
Hey, Rob. It's great to be here.
It's great to have you. And so, well, I want to tell you something. I want to tell the audience here that we actually had recorded this episode before, and unfortunately, the computer gods have stolen it. So we're trying this again. I'm really excited to do this one again because honestly, it was great to get to know you the first time. So let's get to know a little bit more about you the second time, Mustafa. And let's start with asking you about where you grew up.
Yeah, sounds good. Yeah, I was actually born in Baghdad, which is kind of a little fact that a lot of people don't know about me. You know, the mystical land of Aladdin and Arabian Nights and all that, which was cool. But I came to the U.S., grew up out here in Baltimore a couple years later. And so, you know, I was raised in the Baltimore area. Yeah, just as a kid, kind of got into dirt bikes early on. And that was something my parents kind of discouraged me to do. They were like, oh, this is pretty dangerous. You know, why don't you get rid of this dirt bike habit and look into something else? So that's sort of how I made the transition over into computers. I actually had a dirt bike wreck when I was a kid and kind of like smashed up my motorcycle. My parents were like, okay, probably time to get into something else. What else do you like? So I was like, oh, I love video games. I love computers. As a teenager, you know, in the 80s, I was kind of like, hey, there's these new computers coming out, newfangled thing here, these Ataris. So I was like, yeah, let me kind of mess around with this. And so that's kind of how things started. You know, the old machines back then were, you know, just kind of ridiculous compared to today's standards. You know, I had one of these old Ataris with like 8K of RAM, you know, back in the day. They were kind of a new round of computers coming out from Apple and Radio Shack and things like that. So I was like, yeah, let me get one of these and mess around, and got the basic programming language and learned some assembly language. And so as a kid, that's kind of how I started getting into computers. As you know, there's a sort of a ton of great video games also around coming out at the same time. This is, again, back in the 80s. And so just loved kind of getting into some of these classic games on the Atari at the time. You know, Star Raiders was this like space game. It was kind of like an open world, free roaming, first person space shooter, which was really cool. Kind of a great mix of strategy and graphics. And then there was just a ton of other kind of classic Atari games that really inspired me back in the day, like Adventure and, you know, Frogger and Defender and, you know, Robotron and Missile Command and all that stuff that you could, you know, you'd see in the arcade and you could play for the first time on your home computer. So that was a really exciting time for me. And that kind of fed into my interest in college, which was getting into computers and computer graphics, and then especially interested in computers and film, you know, CGI and film.
Yeah, a bit ironic, actually, considering that most parents would have said, you know, at least nowadays, they would say, stop playing video games and get outside. And your parents were all the opposite. Get back inside. Stop doing all that.
Yeah, well, I gave him this, you know, this choice of like, well, do you want me to stick with motorcycles or do you want me to get in and learn some coding on the computer? So that was an easy choice when you put it that way.
Yeah, that's cool. So you go to school and you learn to basically get into the more of the movie industry, from what I understand.
Yeah, that was kind of my interest at the time. I mean, I was a computer science major. Again, during the 80s and 90s, it was sort of like this convergence where, you know, home computers were coming out and starting to take hold. They were really new. You know, a lot of great video games were like, you know, coming onto the scene. And then movie CGI was all growing new, and, you know, all these things were beginning to take off. So, of course, you know, there was also great music also at the time in the 80s. Outside of that, it was kind of this like new birth of digital entertainment, just kind of all coming together. And I was really just amazed by it. And, you know, every year there was some big new development, or like some discovery or a new release of a system or a game, or some movie would drop and people would be amazed. And there were all these new movie techniques that were coming out at the time, like, you know, well, wireframe rendering and fractals and particle systems and, you know, shadows and motion blur, and all these things were sort of just being invented. Like, you know, every year there'd be something new. So I was a CS major, and I was a film minor. And I was like, hey, this is really cool. I love computers. I love video games. There's all these, you know, exciting new things coming out that are kind of converging around here. And I was like, you know, this would be really great to get into. And at the time, like the advances in movie graphics, you know, movies had these bigger budgets and these really expensive, powerful machines and, you know, supercomputers, and they were doing frame by frame rendering. But all these advanced techniques would like later kind of find their way to the PC. Like a few years later, people would figure out a way to like do the same effects or kind of hack the effects in real time, you know, on a cheaper PC. And so you had this kind of, you know, effect where like movies would come out with some new technique, and then video game graphics were like trailing a few years from what the movies were doing. And, you know, now it's kind of, you know, it's really equalized and maybe even flip-flopped to the point where movie studios are using video game engines, you know, like they're using Unreal Engine now to create movies. But at the time it was really cool. And, you know, sort of some of the early movies, you know, like I said, were just kind of getting into this CG thing, you know. So like in the early 80s, you know, I was a kid and I was looking at things like, you know, Tron wasn't really a very good movie, but it was like the first movie to put live actors into a computer generated world. You know, I mean, that was the plot too, but that was also what the movie did. And then there was, I think the Star Trek Wrath of Khan had this like Genesis effect, and it was this fractal landscape with particle systems. And it was really just kind of mind blowing at the time. And then there were things, you know, some other favorites were like The Last Starfighter, which was like, hey, this teenager kind of, you know, goes off to fight aliens in this interstellar war. But, you know, it was kind of a goofy plot, but it was like the first to use CGI for all the spaceship shots. So there were a ton of things like that. And if you were into animation, or if you were into computer graphics at all, if you were in the field, like you'd started to see these shorts coming out from a company called Pixar at the time. It was like, what is this? You know, who are these guys? They were making these short films. Some of the early ones were like Luxo Jr., The Adventures of Andre and Wally B. They were like, you know, using new techniques like photorealistic graphics, motion blur, squash and stretch, or these things. They were starting to bring like traditional animation techniques and use them in films. And they were starting to get nominated for Academy Awards. So this was really cool. It was like, okay, wow, these, you know, they're doing these kind of short, you know, tech heavy movies that are fully computer generated. And someday they're really going to kind of move into using this for, you know, a full movie. So like in the 90s, I was doing my master's degree in computer science. And there was this movie, there was a short at the time called Stanley and Stella Breaking the Ice, which was done by Craig Reynolds and his company. And they figured out how to do sort of simulation of artificial life, especially focused on like flocks, herds and schools, sort of kind of crowd control of these large groups of animated objects. And so they made this little short of a fish and a bird kind of on opposite sides of this globe in this world and sort of trying to get to each other. And so it was like a great demo to show both like the flock of birds and like a school of fish. And I was like, man, this is really cool. Look how they're moving. You know, it's kind of creating this like Brownian motion of this system by moving these individual objects. So I was like, I'm going to do my master's work on this. So I was just really into it. And there was all these just exciting films, you know, following up with, you know, Terminator 2 and the guy kind of coming out of molten metal. And so I was like, man, these effects are great. I'm really into this. And so that was kind of my interest in, you know, starting in the 80s and in the 90s. And then a lot of my friends went off to work at some of those companies. But I kind of eventually made the switch back to just video games and graphics and software development in general. And so that's kind of how I, you know, moved back to the East Coast and really got into the video game software development.
It sounds like kind of like you have the same nostalgia for the 80s that I do.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So much cool stuff, you know, and as a kid in the 80s, it's like, man, all these new things with, you know, film and computers and video games and, you know, great music. And it was just really cool to be around at that time. I'm sure you got fond memories too.
Yeah, it just felt like everything was kind of coming together. It felt very magical. So I remember that very well. And, you know, to your point about the progression of CGI in movies. You know, I remember, you know, The Last Starfighter and Tron and those, and I remember always watching them and thinking, you know, like this stuff kind of felt like, you know, like a trick that just really didn't feel, I mean, it just didn't feel as magical to me at the time. And I remember the movie for me that really cemented the idea of maybe CGI working in movies was Jurassic Park. And, you know, I know that was like mid 90s, but I remember watching that and thinking that, I mean, the CGI that had evolved to the point where, you know, the dinosaurs looked real. And I was just like, wow, like this is the future. And, you know, sure enough, it really, really did become the future.
Yeah. Yeah, totally. You know, you could sort of see this spark on some of these early forays into CG. That was like, well, they're not quite there yet. They're kind of playing with things. You know, they had trouble with natural movement and skin tone and, you know, just people's faces. You kind of had this in the terms like Uncanny Valley, where it's like a person's face just looked like this weird kind of empty, you know, unnatural thing. And they sort of, you know, they just kept working on it and finally got to the point where, you know, like full-length movies, Toy Story and things like that. And yeah, the amazing effects in Jurassic Park and other things just, you know, they really just kind of nailed it. And it's only just, it's getting better and better now to the point where, you know, you really can't believe your eyes anymore. You know, it's just totally seamless and natural. So it's amazing.
Right. Yeah, no, it reminds me of the deep fakes now that they do. Where I cannot tell that these people aren't the real, like the people that they're supposed to be. It's crazy.
Yeah, it's very scary. Yeah. Yeah. Now they're mixing, they're blending like AI and machine learning and things like that to kind of really simulate, you know, based on like looking at, you know, thousands and millions of photos and facial movements and expressions, really simulate, how somebody looks and moves and their voice. And yeah, it's scary now. You really can't tell.
Great stuff. So how did you make the transition back to video games?
I finished, you know, my schooling and I started kind of looking around for work. And I found a really interesting job on the East Coast, you know, which is where my family was. So I wanted to kind of stay in that area. So I found a cool job working for a company called Numerical Design in the Research Triangle area in Chapel Hill, which was really cool. It was a small company. It was, you know, created by one of the professors there, Turner Whitted, who was well known as kind of the inventor of ray tracing at the time. And so they had a really talented group there. They were developing their own kind of high-end rendering engine with ray tracing, and they were involved with video game ports. And the first project I worked on actually was an application for Adobe called Dimensions, which was creating 3D photorealistic graphics out of vectors. So totally new, you know, like, you know, Adobe was big into, you know, lines and curves, like sort of what you'd see with Adobe Illustrator, but they wanted to bring lighting and shadowing and that sort of more photorealistic rendering to something that was rendered with vectors. So it was totally novel at the time. You know, the vector graphics kind of have all these advantages where they can scale to basically any size and still retain quality because they're kind of mathematical expressions of the shape of the object. So we wrote this tool where you could create like a silhouette and like revolve it to make a 3D object or extrude it in 3D and then position lights in the scene. And it was all done with vectors, not pixels. And it was really cool. And eventually Adobe kind of mixed it in, like merged it into, I think it's in Illustrator now. But that was the first thing I worked on with a couple other guys. After that, we got into working on the Hasbro virtual reality system, you know, back then. So again, this is kind of like, you know, mid-90s. Early to mid, and the, you know, VR was this like hot new thing, just the way it is now. You know, it was a hot new thing that was coming out and was going to like take over the world. And so Hasbro was like, this is going to be a great, you know, new toy. We're going to put this out on the market. We want some, you know, great software developers to really make games for it and things like that. So, yeah, so we worked on that and I got to take some of the kind of classical, you know, classic canonical games at the time, like Doom and Magic Carpet and Descent, and take the code for those and then actually port it to the Hasbro VR game system, which was amazing, you know, getting to look at that code and work with that and get it to run in VR. So very cool stuff. And then, you know, went on to port those things also to consoles, you know, Sega Saturn and PlayStation at the time. Yeah, that was a lot of fun. and his great work. That company later went on to make an engine, a game engine called Netimers, which became Gamebryo. That's kind of still used, I think, here and there in various games and other projects. So, yeah, that was very cool. I learned a lot. Enjoyed it.
It is pretty cool. It just kind of seems like you got to participate in like little incremental points of history here. You know, like you were kind of involved a little bit with the development of CGI and how it ends up becoming pretty important to movies. And then you actually got to work with some of the early VR. And honestly, I didn't even know that there was virtual reality systems in the 90s. Other than I think the Nintendo one, which was just like red and black.
Right, right. You know, it couldn't match the hardware power that you have today. So in that sense, it, you know, couldn't really simulate to the level of resolution and frame rate that you need, that you have today. But basically, the same idea was there. They recognized like, hey, this could be really cool. And let's do what we can with the hardware that we have. You know, at the time, they thought the computers were just so powerful and, they were like doubling every year and things like that for every year and a half or whatever. But, you know, compared to what we have today, it's nothing. So it was still kind of a really neat technology. In the end, it didn't make it out the door. I think Hasbro kind of pulled the plug in the end. You know, I think they did some internal testing and they're like, this is kind of dangerous. People putting headsets on and, you know, walking around the house and somebody's going to, you know, fall down the stairs or wander out into traffic or something. And we better change. We better pull the plug on this. It wasn't quite something they wanted to put out for the holidays yet. So, but either way, it was still a blast to kind of be working on that stuff.
Yeah. What could have been, who knows? That would have been pretty cool. So, all right, then where's next? I mean, you were there and then I imagine you stayed in the Baltimore area.
Yeah, so I left that. That was kind of the Chapel Hill Research Triangle area. I left that and then kind of got together with some other folks that were that I had worked with there. I worked at a company called Red Storm, Virtus and Red Storm for a while. That was the birth of Red Storm. Tom Clancy came out and kind of met the team and had, you know, we were brainstorming ideas and kind of came up with, you know, Rainbow Six. And this, so that was the early days of that company. I was only there for, maybe a year or two and then left to do another startup with some of the guys I had worked with at the first company. And we really wanted to make our own game engine. And we had some great ideas for, you know, really nice, you know, 3D graphics and integrating high-end lighting and rendering and shadowing and things with some of the tools at the time. So we created there was a startup called Headspin Technologies that I went to. And we created this engine called Plasma that was actually really cool and got to just work on all the systems from scratch there and kind of build that up. You know, it was using components and dynamic lighting and physics and skinning and facial animation and all this stuff. So that was really cool. We worked on that for a while and kind of put together this great demo. And then we attracted the attention of the folks from Cyan, you know, the guys that did Myst. They were kind of looking for a way to bring their worlds and backstories into 3D because, you know, Myst wasn't like immensely successful at the time, but it was a sort of 2D high quality image, like, you know, kind of point and click puzzle game. And they were like, well, you know, we're seeing 3D graphics, real time graphics really start to take hold. And we, you know, we're looking for a company that can take our like high end worlds and bring them to 3Ds. They really liked what we did. So they kind of merged with our company and bought us. And we all moved out to Spokane, Washington, and joined the Cyan team and worked on Real Myst, which was the kind of Myst in 3D. They had another similar game called Uru, which was, again, like this sort of 3D world, really like lavishly rendered, high detail in 3D with like advanced lighting, shadowing and stuff, and they wanted to put that in a persistent 3D world. So that was just really cool to work on, and we were working on the engine behind that and adding networking and for multiplayer support, and we were also working with a Japanese team called Sunsoft. We would go out and visit them in Japan, and they were sort of doing the Asian port of that. That was great. That was around early 2000s, and really was a blast kind of moving out there to Washington State and working with that team. really enjoyable time of my life there. So yeah, did that for a while. And then, you know, finally, I said, well, a friend of mine told me about an opportunity back in Baltimore. And I was like, well, this might be a chance for me to, you know, move back to kind of my hometown. That's where my you know, family was and old friends and stuff. So the company was Firaxis, and they were looking for some folks to work on the next civilization. And so they kind of had a lead role opening there. So I was like, okay, I'm going to jump on this. So moved back to the Hunt Valley, Maryland area. Got to work with Soren and, you know, brought on Alex Mansaris and Tom Whitaker and, you know, just a lot of the other guys that I'm working with now that are, you know, super talented. Yeah, and that's when we were doing Civ 4. So, yeah, that was great. That was, you know, one of the most exciting games and one of the games I'm most proudest of that we put together. And that was kind of my first time working with these guys and really working on a great strategy.
I'm curious, were you aware of how influential this game was going to become? Like, as you were developing it and as it was nearing release, were you just kind of aware of just how great Civilization IV was? Did you feel that kind of specialness from it?
I didn't really know the sort of the history of Civ and the legacy of it before I got out there. You know, I'd heard of Sid Meier, and it was, you know, just kind of an honor to be able to work with Sid on some of the later games. At the time, you know, Soren was the main designer I was working with for Civ 4. And I kind of quickly knew, once I got into it, I was like, wow, these games are really special. And I started to realize, like, there was such a big community around it. And that so many people just, like, around the world were, like, you know, enamored with this game. And just couldn't put it down, you know. And it was, like, just the whole one more turn. Saying, and I was like, wow, this is really something special. And like to this day, that's probably the product that people know the most when they say, like, you know, what have you worked on? You know, if I mention some of the other things, they're like, okay, that sounds cool. But if I say, yeah, I worked on Civilization, they're like, oh, whoa, are you serious? I've heard of that. I played that. I played Civ 2 or Civ 3 or Civ 5, you know, whatever it is. It's kind of something that's, you know, known everywhere. And so that was really cool getting to do a great version of Civ that, you know, people loved and was, like, you know, well received, and get to work with the community. A lot of talented people. We're still working with some of them now and have some of them at with us at Mohawk. And that was just, you know, really special to be able to work on that title.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, still among the 4X community, I think that a lot of people still consider Civilization IV to be the best entry. So to have that in your resume is pretty darn cool.
Yeah, no, that was really great. And we wanted to kind of take, you know, really take Civ IV and run with it, make it as moddable as possible. So I actually worked a lot on bringing in a scripting language. We did a lot with Python. We kind of broke out the AI and, you know, a lot of the core game code into DLLs. We made everything data driven and kind of allowed, you know, heavy XML usage. So there were a lot of different things. Of course, you know, Soren had just amazing ideas for design, keeping the old stuff. I think, you know, his philosophy was like, you know, I'm going to keep 1/3 of it as is. I'm going to make 1/3 of it improved. And then I'm going to take the last third and do something new. And it's kind of this great mix of, like, familiar with new stuff. And so I think that really worked out well. And then after that, they were just different expansions and follow-ups that I had kind of moved on to the next game. I left those, you know, sort of DLCs and expansions in the hands of some of the other talented folks. And I moved on to Civ Revolution, which was cool. I got to work more closely with Sid Meier's, and we were doing console versions of those games. So it was great to work on the Xbox 360 and the PS3. And so that was just kind of a different style of game, sort of smaller, easier to pick up and play, more kind of more fun, more casual almost. And, you know, figuring out how to make it work on the console, which is obviously, like, you know, totally different UI and things like that. So that was really a blast as well. And so did that. And that game was a lot of fun and did well. And then got to work on XCOM. I was kind of early on in that. I think sort of for the first year or two, we were doing a lot of prototyping and pre-production and figuring out what, you know, what Firaxis wanted to do with XCOM and what tech should they use. And so we actually spun up on Unreal Engine. That was a big change for the company there. And we were figuring out how to handle destructible worlds and procedural worlds. That was great. And then just about the time that that took off, I left. You know, that game also went on to be really successful. But that's when I left Firaxis and moved to Autodesk and Scaleform, working on UI. So it's a change of pace.
Weren't they involved with Civilization 4 as well?
Yeah, that's kind of how I got to know the folks at Scaleform. Was for Civ 4, we were looking for like a UI toolkit and UI libraries that we could use to help us kind of get the game done. And making a good UI system is a lot of work, especially sophisticated one, you know, with like, you know, complex logic and rendering and everything, and animation and everything. So we found a local company called Scaleform that was making this user interface system. And so we got to work with them and we utilized their tech, and they actually helped us out doing some of the screens. Their tech was based around, eventually kind of it was based around Flash. And that was sort of their inspiration for it. And so you could use the Adobe, the Flash editor and ActionScript for your logic and sort of the whole like timeline that that supported. So you could kind of take Flash and ActionScript code and graphics, do your UI with that, and then bring that into the Scaleform libraries, which would let it run on basically any platform, you know, PC, consoles, you know, mobiles, different operating systems, whatever. So that was really cool. That was, you know, Civ 4 was kind of the first proving ground for that company and for the early version of that technology. And then it got really successful and was used in probably almost any major, you know, all the top publishers and developers at the time, you know, 2K and Disney and Square and Ubisoft and Sony and Microsoft, I mean, Activision, like you name it, Valve, they were all kind of at one point or another, like using Scaleform for their games. And even to this day, you know, you look back at, you know, like, you know, Mass Effect, Gears of War and Crysis and Sims and Borderlands. I mean, it was in so many titles. So it was very cool to work on that. It was no longer like we were not developing games anymore that, you know, would come out for the holidays or anything. We were developing tools and libraries and documentation and demos and kind of dealing with customers. So we would just put out regular releases. So it was less of a kind of a big buildup and then like a heavy crunch period like you'd find in some of the traditional game companies. It was more of a kind of consistent, you know, more manageable release schedule, I think, which was one of the attractions to me to get out of games, take a break from games and get into libraries and tools.
Nice. And I imagine that eventually you got tired of the easier schedule and wanted to get back into the crunch, right?
Yeah. In a way, at that point I was, kind of doing half coding, half management, kind of as like a engineering director. And after a while doing that, I was, you know, missing kind of getting back into games and doing more coding. My next kind of position out after that, Autodesk wound up sort of buying Scaleform and kind of merging it into their library of tools and SDKs. They had collected a few of these. And they sort of called them all Gameware, and then they picked up the Stingray engine. And so they were kind of getting into games for a while. And then after, you know, a few years of that, they sort of said, well, we're going to move out of games and kind of stick with our own specialties and strengths, you know, their hero products like, you know, Max and Maya and doing things for architecture and things like that and simulation. So they sort of start to scale down their game tech groups. And so that's about when I left Autodesk, stopped working on Scaleform and moved to another local company, Big Huge Games, which, you know, was a great place to work and had a lot of the same folks, you know, in the Baltimore game development community, people that had, had roots at Firaxis or other places. And so it was really cool to kind of get back into that community and work with those developers again. Yeah, so at Big Huge Games, I really got into mobile development and was the engineering director for the team out there. We had worked on a title called Dominations, which was, again, kind of a online blend of like Civilization meets Clash of Clans type of thing, you know, where you could kind of have a base, you know, build up a persistent base and then go to war against other people. But then you could pick your nation and your troops and decide sort of what you wanted to focus on in regards to, you know, different sorts of skills or different ages of, you know, basically moving through some of the ancient ages to the modern ages. So it was a really cool, you know, concept I was familiar with, but it was taking it onto mobile and kind of making it massively, you know, online. I think they had, you know, tens of millions of players, and it made, you know, 100 million in revenue or whatever. It was a fun game, really successful game. But at that place there, I was involved heavily into management. And so I was great. Was there for about 4 years or so. And then I was always kind of staying in touch with my friends at Mohawk. And that's when I made the jump over to Mohawk and got together again. And with the guys I had worked with on Civ 4, got to work on Old World. So.
And here we are. So what are the, exactly. So what is your primary responsibility when it comes to Old World?
Yeah, a lot of different things. You know, I tried to, you know, help out with management and hiring and onboarding and things like that. But I'm also working on just different parts of the code, especially like the animation system, working on units, unit movement, bringing some like living world elements into the game, working with the artists on different effects. And we added the Mac version, so I'm helping out with that as well. I'm also kind of working closely with Epic on our integration into their ecosystem and just, you know, always working on optimizations, working with Tom Whitaker on getting things faster and reducing tech debt and just, you know, tools in general, helping out, making sure the build system's working, putting, you know, standards in place and processes and things like that. So a lot of different things there, but it's what's great is it's, you know, it's people that I'm familiar with. They're, you know, super talented that I've worked with before. And it's like a heavy dose of technology and coding. And we're excited to for the imminent launch here.
Right. Yeah. You're just a few weeks away from that. So I imagine that you guys are all pretty busy. But I do understand, too, that Mohawk is a crunchless environment, right? You guys try to stay away from crunch.
Yeah, absolutely. We're, you know, we're a veteran crew, and so we've all been through that before, and we kind of know that, you know, in the end, it's not something that's sustainable, and we want to balance, you know, the quality of life of everybody, and we want our employees to be happy and kind of be successful long-term. So we really, you know, frown on any kind of like heavy crunch or things like that. And most of the team is, you know, really efficient and experienced. And so we're able to get our things done in a reasonable amount of times. And we all kind of take accountability for the things we're working on. So if somebody like signs up to do something and they can't get it done or they need to take time off and or something comes up, you know, they're usually on their own. They will make up the time and knock it out, you know, by working a little bit later or work some time on a weekend or something. That's sort of, you know, on their own accord. So, but it's a really great environment. And we started out, at least when I got there, there was kind of a, you know, new office space for the company, which was nice. But then, once COVID hit, we all moved remote and, realized that, we still worked great, fully remote. And so, we were able to kind of, you know, shut down the office space essentially. I mean, it's still available, if we need to get in there, but we all work remotely and we have people from around the world now joining the team. And since we're kind of small enough and experienced enough, it's a great environment. You know, no time is lost to commuting or things like that anymore. So it's worked out really well for us.
That segues into my next question pretty well, actually. I was just curious to know, clearly it didn't affect you guys too much, but has there been any workflow changes for you in particular when it comes to working remotely?
Nothing major. I think, you know, with working remotely, you just need to, you know, make the effort to communicate with people regularly. It's easy to sort of get into a habit where you're just, you know, at your own desk doing your thing. And there's always conversations going on in Slack, but it's important to still kind of, you know, chat with people when you need to have some of those kind of on the fly discussions about things that occur in the office naturally, but require a little bit more effort when you're, you know, remote like that. So just kind of recognizing those things, pulling people in for a quick call or a quick chat on something that you're working on, and, you know, making the effort to keep the communication flowing is the only thing that's really changed.
Yeah, that's good to hear. So with regards to your personal life, I mean, how much has COVID changed? I mean, I kind of feel like we're rounding the corner a bit now, which is great. It feels like things are starting to return to normalcy, but, like, you know, throughout the period where it was kind of shut down a bit, how was your personal life affected?
You know, for me, there wasn't a big deal. I tend to do a lot of things from home anyway. So for me, it was just kind of more time to work on home projects and, you know, play around with new tech and things like that. We had decided to sell our house last year and just kind of downsize a little bit. And so once we decided to work remotely, that kind of opened things up so that we could kind of move anywhere we wanted. And so that worked out great. Found a really nice place. It's a little bit further out from, it's not near any of the places I've worked with before, but now that we're doing things remotely, that's been fine, you know, and so that's kind of been super flexible. And a lot of the things I like to do, you know, like, you know, work out, hit the gym, now I can do at home, and I'm interested in martial arts and kind of always playing with that and training with that. Again, that's something that I can do here a lot, you know, on my own. And so the hobbies that I've been doing and the things that I'm interested in, yeah, haven't really been, hasn't been a problem for me.
Right. I remember in our last episode, we shared a mutual love for Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu. And you told me about how you've been training for some time, and so have I. And I imagine that's probably the only thing that's really changed is that you can't really train with partners. So that makes it a little bit more difficult.
Yeah. 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 That's definitely a drawback. I've kind of switched more to, like, some of the striking aspects of things. Yeah, I know you're an MMA fan too. So, you know, like, Muay Thai is the other kind of toolkit in the arsenal when you can't really do grappling per se. There's a lot of striking that you can do on your own. And so I've actually kind of focused more on that recently since COVID. And that's, you know, easy to do with the heavy bags and those sorts of things. So that's worked great. And I've also, you know, we've got a lot of space out here, so I spend time with my dog. We've got a German Shepherd out here who's a lot of fun. I'm, you know, always chasing him around and training him and playing with him. And then another thing I've been kind of picked up, and it sounds like you mentioned this as well as an interest for you, is, you know, picked up chess again, sort of when over COVID, and watching Queen's Gambit on Netflix like everybody else. I was like, oh yeah, this is cool. I used to play. Let me pick this up again. And so it's another sort of almost solo, remote friendly activity. And I actually play, have a lot of epic challenges with my daughter and a lot of great matches with her. So it's still fun times here.
That's great. Yeah, I have a small confession to make. I used to play a bunch when I was in the military, because of course there's a lot of downtime in the military, and sometimes you're just sitting around, and it would be kind of cheating, but I would go home and I would actually watch the AI play on computer, and I'd, you know, kind of like, you know, mimic their moves and then go back and play my fellow Marines, and I would win because I was basically learning from, you know, very advanced AI. And they're like, how are you so good? And I never told them. This is the first time I've ever said it. So if they're listening to this, I'm sorry.
You got to return all that bet money.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, no, that's great stuff. Well, so, I mean, it seems like, I mean, for the most part, I mean, I don't want to speak for you, but it does seem like COVID almost didn't really affect you too much. I mean, of course, you know, there's some small changes to your lifestyle, but for the most part, it sounds like you were able to actually make some decent moves and, you know, get through it without too much scars.
Yeah, I think that's fair to say. You know, we're still super glad that it's looks like it's coming to an end now. And it's nice to be able to go out now and not wear a mask in a lot of places. I mean, we're you know, fully vaccinated now here. So it's nice now that summer's here, being able to, you know, go sit outside, or, you know, go eat, or, you know, go to a event or something like that, and not feel as worried about it as you did in the past. And I think for a lot of people, you know, it's just been more challenging just mentally, like the sort of lack of same level of social interaction. I know, I think for some of my kids, it's been hard. They, you know, they're things like, you know, high school graduations and being going off to college, you know, those things happened during COVID, and they missed out on a lot of those things. And it just sort of made things a lot harder and more awkward, kind of trying to do all those things remote. So for me, you know, not as much, being a, you know, computer nerd and introvert and just whatever, I'm like, yeah, it's not a big deal to me, but I definitely am glad it's on its way out.
Right. Yeah. So I want to just shift back to Old World real quick before we wrap things up. And I'm curious to know, I mean, as your time with it, at least until 1.0 kind of winds down, what's left on your personal agenda?
Yeah, mainly just kind of, you know, making sure everything is moving smoothly to the finish line, you know, just making sure we land this well. We've done a great job of keeping the fans and the community involved and having an early access application and letting the community give feedback and play it sort of all along. So I think we're in a really good position. And we did, you know, that's some of the same strategies we used on Civ 4 was also kind of having something, you know, playable early, having multiplayer in there early, and then just rapidly iterating on it, you know, finding the fun, as they say, you know, polishing it, but having that sort of always playable. And then just, you know, continually refining it with feedback. So we've been doing that, which is great. And that helps us work through all the kinks with, you know, pushing releases out and making sure everything is correct in the, let's say, you know, in the Epic Store. So we mainly want to just make sure things are still working. You know, we don't want any major breaking changes at this point. We want to get the performance as good as we can. And just there's a lot of sort of final polish and various things we want to get in just as we, you know, hit the runway here at the end or land the plane. So it's exciting. It's going to be a great release.
Yeah, Mustafa, I'll say that you're part of an extraordinary team, and I'm sure you're included among them because, I mean, first of all, the development process has been handled so well. And this is the first game where I have kind of seen the game from the ground up from a very early stage. And then once it hit early access, the fact that you guys managed to put out new builds every week that were stable is still, it's mind boggling to me. I mean, you guys clearly are very, you know, very experienced, you know, veterans here, because I can't think of a single other development team that puts out weekly builds that still work.
Yeah. Well, we have, you know, we have a crack QA team, and everybody does a great job kind of caring about their work and checking their work and keeping builds working. Yeah, when you have a, you know, talented team and experienced team like that, we're lucky we're able to move really fast but still, you know, keep the quality level up. So, you know, now you've probably jinxed us. So.
Sorry, I'm so sorry. I thought about that as I was finishing my sentence. I was like, man, they still have a few weeks left. Maybe I shouldn't say this.
Yeah, we're sunk now, basically. So.
Yeah, now there's going to be some sort of explosion, and I'm sorry. Well, you can blame it on me. Well, Mustafa, I know that you don't do social media, but is there anywhere that someone could find you if they wanted to maybe catch up with you or ping you or say hi?
Yeah, I'm not out there very much. LinkedIn is probably the best place to look me up and, you know, shoot me a message to connect or something like that.
Excellent. Great. Well, Mustafa, it's been incredibly good to get to know you. I learned something new this time. I didn't realize that you were born in Baghdad. So that wasn't something that we got to talk about the first time. And a few other things that you mentioned this time around that you didn't say the first time. So it was cool to get to know you even further.
Yeah, let's just not have to do this again next week.
That's my promise. You won't have to. Well, great. Thanks again, Mustafa. I really appreciate you joining me today.
Yeah, my pleasure, Rob. Great to talk to you.